Right, Rabbi Reis is now going to be speaking on reflections relating to the resolution of the World Trade Center Aguna cases. Rabbi Reis.
Thank you very much. The hour is a little bit late, so I'll try to get right into the gist of the presentation. I would like to urge you, as much as possible, to ask me questions. So don't feel obligated to wait until I get to the conclusion of the presentation. If you want to chime in at any time with questions, please feel free to do so. But I just want to give a little bit of the basic background of the tragic cases that the Beth Din of America dealt with in the context of the 9/11 tragedies. I mentioned in the introductory remarks that shortly after the terrible tragedy occurred, the Beth Din of America was approached by a number of different families who had unfortunately suffered losses from the tragedy, where there were husbands of women who had worked in either the North Tower or the South Tower of the World Trade Center, and they turned to the Beth Din of America for a resolution of the halakhic issues. It was a very emotionally difficult time for us as we tried to attend to the work that we had to do from a halakhic perspective without becoming too emotionally overwhelmed by the facts and circumstances that we were dealing with. And this was indeed a very trying and very challenging task. But we realized very early on that our role and our responsibility was precisely to perform this particular aspect of the response to 9/11, which was the proper halakhic process, the proper halakhic analysis. And I'll begin with the end, which is that it was my sense at the time in which we actually worked on resolving all of these different cases, that the fact that there was some type of a framework was a device that actually enabled the families to have a certain level of comfort, that there was a support system that the Torah had actually put into place to embrace people who had suffered such colossal catastrophe and to provide a framework of how you deal with it, of turning to a Beis Din, of compiling the evidence, of having the meetings, of having this process. And just recently, actually, one of the fathers of one of the widows of the 9/11 tragedy came over to me and said that he had been meaning to tell me this for a very long time, and actually reinforced this notion that there was, to whatever degree was possible, something that he felt he wanted to share with me, uplifting, about the way that the Beis Din was able to access traditional halakhic literature and traditional halakhic processes in terms of providing for what could be called maybe the meaning that can be extracted from halakha, which is at times an intangible, but the very process of halakha itself has the capacity and provided that capacity of providing for a certain measure of comfort. And we went through all of those processes in every respect, in terms of dealing with the mourning issues, in terms of dealing with burial issues, and of course, ultimately, in terms of dealing with the resolution of the Aguna questions. Just to briefly review the facts, what happened on September 11th, broken down into the actual timeline, was that at 8:46 a.m. in the morning, the North Tower was struck. The North Tower was struck at approximately the 92nd floor. The hit on the 92nd floor in the World Trade Center North Tower went through the middle of the floor in a very clear, very direct fashion. And as a result, the top floors above the 92nd floor were completely severed in terms of any access to elevators or stairs from anything below. And there were no survivors, not one, from anybody who was found above the point of impact in the North Tower from the 92nd floor and upwards. The major firm that was located in that area, besides Windows on the World, which some of you, I would imagine, during the course of your lives actually were present there. It happens I was there once for a chasana, probably about a year or so before the tragedy. Besides Windows on the World, Cantor Fitzgerald, which was a brokerage firm, was probably the hardest hit of all the firms above that point of impact. And that's because that as a bond brokerage firm, brokers in the bond market would typically report to work very early in the morning. So even by 8:46 in the morning, 650 out of the 1,000 employees of Cantor Fitzgerald were already found in their offices, and that's the number that were lost. Approximately 650 employees from Cantor Fitzgerald were all killed that day. We spoke to whomever that was at Cantor Fitzgerald who actually reported to work that day, but had left early. There were maybe two or three people who fell into that category, just so that we could ask them whether they had seen any of the husbands whose cases came before us who had worked in Cantor Fitzgerald. Three out of the 10 cases that came to the Benton of America involved husbands who worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. There was also a law firm, an insurance brokerage firm that was approximately the 96th to 97th floor above the point of impact. And one of the cases that came to us at the Benton of America involved an individual who worked in the insurance brokerage firm. So all told, four out of the cases that came to the Benton of America involved individuals who were found or who worked in the area above the point of impact in the North Tower. And in those cases, basically the inquiry was straightforward. Because, as I mentioned earlier, and this is really found in source one, and I'm not going to go through an extensive reading, time doesn't permit, of the various sources, but as mentioned, the Gemara essentially, the Mishnah and the Gemara in Yevamos essentially distinguish between two different types of paradigms of cases of the missing husbands. One is the case of a man who falls into a body of water with visible boundaries, what's called Mayim Sheyesh Lahemsof. If a single eyewitness can place the person, saw the person falling into the water and stayed a long enough time that they saw the person didn't emerge, then we can conclude that the person has died and permit the widow to remarry. And that's because since there were clear boundaries, the person would have seen had the individual who fell into the water emerged from the water. And the other type of paradigm is the paradigm of Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof, where there is a witness who sees a husband fall into water that doesn't have clear boundaries. It's, say, a large body of water like an ocean, where the Gemara is worried that maybe the person was carried off to a more distant location by waves or some other force, and the onlooker did not see, and therefore the mere fact that the onlooker did not see the individual emerge after a period of time is not sufficient testimony to allow the woman to remarry. And the Gemara in Yevamos on Daf Kuf Kaf Aleph Amud Aleph even relates a story about a person who fell into such a body of water. It was assumed by the onlooker that he had died, and they observed a funeral process the next day in which eulogies were delivered. And in the middle of the eulogies, the missing person walked in and saw that eulogies were being made on his behalf, because since it was Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof, there were more avenues of escape in such a large, boundless body of water. And therefore, the conclusion is that because of the severity of the prohibition of Eishes Ish, of a woman marrying when she's already married to somebody else, and the illegitimacy of any child that would be born, even though we relax evidentiary procedures and we don't require two witnesses, because of the principle of Mishum Aguna Akul Kilu Bei Rabbanon, that we try to make things more lenient in order to enable a woman not to be an aguna, we also have to be sensitive to the chomer, to the severity of the prohibition of Eishes Ish, of a woman being permitted to remarry when she's not in fact a single woman. And therefore, we have to make sure that we do not rely, says the Gemara, on a probability of death that falls into the category of Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof. However, if you have satisfied the criteria of Mayim She'yesh Lahem Sof, where there is in fact a certainty of death or a very near certainty of death, the Tosfos asked the question about, we know that there were people who were miraculously saved from situations over the course of Jewish history. However, the conclusion of Tosfos is that we do not worry about what we call Maise Nisim. We don't worry about miraculous events that may occur. We have to base ourselves upon regular probabilities of Teva, of the normal laws of the universe, and therefore we do not fear the way that the Yushami indicates that maybe a miracle occurred. So therefore, in the case of any men who were found above the point of the 92nd floor, where there was no possible means of escape, all that you would need to establish is that we know that they were in fact there at the time that the plane hit the building, where they would be in a situation that the Gemara basically treats the same as Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Soap, of a man who falls into a bounded body of water. It would be more what we refer to as Kipshin or Eish, a man who falls into a fiery furnace, which is subject to the same rules, where you know that a person who falls into a deep fiery furnace could not possibly have survived. So our investigative work, in order to comply with the halakhic criteria, was focused upon the question of, do we know that the people were there? And in those four cases, two of those cases, we had evidence of direct telephone conversations that people had with the individuals after the plane hit, where in one case a wife called up and the husband said, yes, a plane just hit our building and we're trying to figure out how to get out. So we know now that there was no way to get out. But since the telephone conversation took place, for purposes of aguna situations, you can rely even on the testimony of a relative, even on the testimony of the wife herself, and therefore that testimony was good enough, although we did actually even obtain the telephone records. There was another case where it wasn't the wife who spoke to the person, to the husband, but it was the husband's friend who was called by the husband. The husband called him and said, something just happened to our building, and there was a big explosion, we're trying to figure out what happened. And the friend said, I think I just heard on the radio that it was a plane that hit your building, and this was the conversation that took place. And based on this conversation and the friend's recounting of this conversation with us, we were able to place the husband in his office after the time of collision in the North Tower above the 92nd floor. Therefore, that would be akin to Kipshana Aish. He would either have been consumed by the fire or toppled 100 stories to his death. There was no point, there was no possibility of escape, and therefore that would be sufficient on halakhic grounds to make a determination of death. Then there was a third case where the conversations that took place were conversations that took place prior to the actual collision of the plane into the building. And then there's a halakhic discussion about, do we say that since the person was known to have been in the building, was known to have been in their office, say, 10 minutes beforehand, we can assume that they probably didn't leave the place where they were, and that's called a chazakah. Do you have a presumption that since the person was there, they remained there? But in that case, we didn't have to ultimately rely upon that question, because ultimately remains were found of that person, and they were found in a way that satisfies the halakhic criterion of a body identification. What's the halakhic criterion of body identification? Either you look at the body and you recognize the body, because when you look at a person, you can recognize the person. That's called tfias ayin. It's called, you don't know, you're not recognizing the person because you remember his nose is this big, or his eyes are that big, or the distance between the nose and the mouth is that big. You just look at a person and you know it's that person. That's called tfias ayin. But when a tragedy of this sort occurs and people are just blown apart and people's bodies are completely decimated, then usually you don't have the benefit of tfias ayin. So you have to rely upon other types of physical identification. And there the Gemara distinguishes between simen muvak, an ironclad form of identification that can be relied upon, and what's called simanim beinonim or gruim, forms of identification that are not as strong. Like, for example, the fact that we knew that a person was tall, and you find remains of a tall person. There are a lot of tall people. The fact that a person wore a certain brand of pants. So a lot of people wear a certain brand of pants. So you can't rely on those forms of identification. But if a person has something unique physically that would pertain only to them, or where it would pertain to them in a fashion in which the possibility that it pertained to somebody else would be less than 1 in 1,000, and Rav Schechter actually, when he was describing the 1 in 1,000 rule in a shir shortly after the 9/11 tragedy, said that whenever you have a tragedy, say, that involves 3,000 people, so then the probability of error has to be, the margin of error has to be less than 1 in 3,000. But most of the types of forms of identification that have a margin of error of less than 1 in 1,000 also have a margin of error of less than 1 in 3,000. Not all of them, but most of them. And for example, dental x-rays are a type of identification where if you know a person's dental formation of teeth, that is considered to be very unique to the individual. It's extremely unlikely that somebody else would have it. And this person in question was identified ultimately through a fragment of the skull, unfortunately, which enabled an identification through dental identification, and therefore that was considered to be a sufficient form of identification. But then there was a fourth person who worked. Yes, please. This is a big dispute among the different poskim. There's a big dispute among halakhic authorities, and I'll just repeat the question, as to whether if you have one form of identification, like, for example, a pair of pants that is the right size and the right brand and in the right location of where, you know, you knew that this person was and you know that the person is missing, but that alone would not be sufficient. But then you have other forms of identification that also would not be self-sufficient alone, that you can add to that one. Can you combine different forms of identification together? This is a big machlokes of poskim. It's a big dispute among the poskim. It's brought in Siman Yud Zayin of Eben HaEzer, in the 17th Siman of Eben HaEzer in the Shulchan Aruch, and discussed at great length in the volume called Otzer HaPoskim that is focused on all the issues of Siman Yud Zayin. There are two volumes. Otzer HaPoskim is a famous work that goes through basically many of the siman and many of the chapters of Eben HaEzer in Shulchan Aruch, and Siman Yud Zayin, which is the siman that the chapter that is devoted to the identification of bodies, is most prolifically discussed siman in all of Eben HaEzer. In the Otzer HaPoskim, there are at least two volumes of Otzer HaPoskim that are devoted only to Siman Yud Zayin. So many pages that are devoted to precisely that question, and that question became relevant actually in one of the cases, at least one of the cases dealt with by the Betin of America that we're going to discuss very shortly. But just to go in order, in terms of the cases of the men who were above the points of collision in the North Tower, so there was one individual, and Rabbi Willig alluded to this in his opening remarks, who could not be placed in the building that day, meaning that there was no eyewitness testimony. It wasn't even as good as a Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof case. Even in a Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof case, a case of water without clear boundaries, at the very least you have a probability of death that's established by a witness having seen the person fall into the water. But that requires at least a witness that places the person in a location of probability of death. Here, we knew the person worked in this office. We know that he left for work that morning, but nobody actually saw him in the office. So can you rely upon a normal pattern of travel? And there are certain shuvos that discuss this. There is a responsum by Rav Herzog, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Levi Herzog, who is the chief rabbi of Israel, and he discusses a case where a person was known to go to a bus stop, the Tachana Merkazit, and there was a terrorist attack in the Tachana Merkazit, and it was blown, people were blown up, and the person was not found afterwards, and it was known he was on his way to Tachana Merkazit. And Rav Herzog argues that if you have compelling circumstantial evidence, this is something that could be taken into account. But you have to make it compelling. So what we were able to do in this case is that we found out from the widow that the person normally purchased his Metro card The husband normally purchased his Metro card through his credit card. So she obtained the credit card records. The credit card records were able to identify the time of purchase of the Metro card, and then we were able to get the specific number of the Metro card, and then we turned it to the New York City Transit Authority, and the New York City Transit Authority identified every single time that this Metro card had been used for the entire period prior to 9/11, and of course the fact that it hadn't been used since then, and we were able to see exactly what time this husband placed his Metro card through the turnstile at the Port Authority 42nd Street Station on the way to the World Trade Center, which was the station that he used to get to the World Trade Center station. And we were able to see even when the Metro card went through the station, went through the turnstiles on the day of September 11th. So we know that he got that far and that he was following his normal pattern. We also obtained from the Port Authority, because it turned out that every single person who worked in the World Trade Center had swipe cards. And they would use the swipe cards to get through the door of the World Trade Center, and it would register when they would go through the door every single day. So it happens that when the World Trade Center was attacked on September 11th, all of the Port Authority swipe card records were destroyed as well. They had a backup, but the backup was at the same location, so the backup was destroyed as well. So we didn't have the benefit of the swipe card records, which of course would have been a tremendous form of evidence that the person entered into the building, but they did provide for us the swipe card records for the month of August. So we were able to trace during the month of August the normal amount of time, since we also had the Metro card records, the normal amount of time that it took to get from the 42nd Street station when he would go through with his Metro card to when he would arrive every single day at the World Trade Center. And we were able algebraically to figure out what was the normal amount of time and even what was the longest amount of time. And then since we had the Metro card record for September 11th itself, when he went through the subway station, we were able to figure out algebraically when he would have been expected to be in his office that day. And based on the expectations and based on the evidence of how long it typically took for the elevator to get up from the first floor to the express elevator bank on the 78th floor, and then from the 78th floor where the express elevators entered to get up the local elevator to his office, we placed the probable time that he arrived in his office at approximately 4 or 5 minutes before the tragedy occurred. And based on that compelling circumstantial evidence, there was a basis to rely upon the tshuva of Herzog, that particular case may have been the Dvar Yehoshua, Rabbi Yehoshua Ehrenberg, also had a case as well. I think Rav Herzog's case may have involved the collapse of a bridge, and Rav Ehrenberg's case was the case of the Tachana HaMerkazit, of the bus station. But be it as it may, there were halakhic precedents enabling us to be able to rely upon this type of a cheshbon, this type of a calculation, in terms of being able to reach the conclusion that he was definitely in his office at the time of the World Trade Center tragedy. In addition, in that particular case, after we had done that analysis, there also was an identification made based on a fragment of skin tissue from this individual, a fragment of bone, of DNA identification as well. And therefore, since DNA identification, as I mentioned, is something where the margin of error is likely less than 1 in 1 billion, even though it's not visible to the naked eye, it's certainly based on even the most strict of poskim when it comes to DNA evidence, something that could be utilized together with other compelling circumstantial evidence, which is what we had in this particular case. So those were the four husbands who were found, who were located north of the North Tower, above the point of impact of the airplane on the 92nd floor. In the South Tower, it was a little bit more complicated. There were three cases that came to us, four cases that came to us of men who worked in the South Tower. In the South Tower, the plane hit at approximately 9:02 in the morning, about 15 minutes after the North Tower was attacked. The North Tower, even though it was attacked first, it actually collapsed last. It collapsed around 10:28 in the morning. The North Tower was hit around 9:02 in the morning and collapsed around 9:58 in the morning. The South Tower was hit at 9:02 in the morning and collapsed around 9:58 in the morning. So the South Tower was hit last, but actually collapsed first. And in the South Tower, the plane hit on the 78th floor, approximately the 78th floor, around where the express elevators were located, but it hit in a zigzag fashion. In other words, instead of it being a direct hit that completely severed the top from the bottom, the way the North Tower was hit, the South Tower was hit in a zigzag fashion, so there actually still was one point of access that was not completely cut off. There was one staircase from which people were still able to descend even after the building was hit. Now, what does that mean, people were able to descend? A lot of people were hit directly by the airplane or directly in the point of impact of the direction of the airplane, and they would have been incinerated or they would have been completely destroyed at the moment of impact of the plane. But if somebody actually found themselves in a corner, the northwest corner, where the plane did not hit directly, then there was still a possibility that somebody or a few people may have been able to go down the stairs, and there were several people that it was recorded and documented that they were able to go down the smoky staircase. When they got to the bottom of the smoky staircase, they were generally found all basically scarred and full of smoke and in a very dilapidated or very disheveled condition, and they were sent to a triage station where they were taken to local hospitals. So there were three men basically who worked in offices that were north of the 70 that were above the 78th floor in the South Tower. And we had to identify, first of all, that we knew they were there. And based on different telephone conversations and evidence that we received from people, we were able to identify in each one of these three cases that we knew that the men were located in their offices at least between the time of when the North Tower was hit and when the South Tower was hit. And they were talking to various relatives about what they should do. Since they were in the South Tower, should they stay in their offices, should they leave? And they had these conversations in those 15 minutes between 8:48 when the North Tower was hit and 8:46 and 9:02 when the South Tower was hit. So so we had the evidence that these people were in the building. Two of them worked in the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance, which was located in the 86th and 87th floors of the South Tower. And one of them worked for a law firm, I think it was called Harris Beach, which was also located on one of the floors in the South Tower above the 78th floor. So here, even if we knew that they were actually there, that was not sufficient because of the fact that there still was a possible point of egress. There actually was a possible point of escape for these individuals. So in the case of one of these individuals, we knew he was there. Interestingly, we knew he was there because there was a case of a man who came to us for a declaration of death for his wife, where the standard of proof really only requires halakhically a probability of death, according to the Gesher HaChaim, akin to Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof. And when we were interviewing this man, so it emerged in the conversation with this man that he said that his mother, I believe, was speaking to his wife on the phone, and his wife, in the course of that conversation, mentioned that she was sitting next to this individual who was one of the husbands of the cases that was presented to us by the wife of that husband. So as a result of this other case coming into the Beis Din, we got the testimony that we needed, just parenthetically, placing this other individual in the building. Yes?
Just the fact that the person doesn't volunteer to come home and what they're still alive, or if our family will be injured, is that considered at all as evidence of anything?
So this is a question that we had to deal with, meaning that in one of these three cases, and one that we had to deal with that question, and I'll explain to you why. In one of the cases, we had the situation that was asked about earlier, where you have a combination of different forms of identification. We knew the person was in the building. A pair of pants was then found that met his victim identification profile. It's called the VIP, victim identification profile, the type of pants he was wearing. That wasn't a sufficient form of identification in and of itself, but inside the pants pockets were a wallet, and the wallet had his driver's license, and the wallet had credit cards, and there was also a ring that he had that was inside one of the pockets. And the Gemara discusses, can you rely on a person's wallet? Can you rely upon a person's ring? Do we say that those are items that a person never lends out? And if you find them, then it must be that it belongs to this person. Or do we say, chayshin in l'she'ela, that maybe he loaned it out to somebody else? And many poskim say that if it's a real type of a very valuable object or personal, a very precious personal object, like a ring or like a wallet, then we would assume that the person would not have loaned it out and you could rely upon that. So even though there's a dispute about that, since we had multiple forms of identification here, multiple forms of what might be called a little less than ironclad because it's not a physical identification of the person himself, but we had pants that matched the profile, we had the fact that we knew that he was in his office shortly before the building was hit, and we also had multiple forms of identification. We had a sunglasses case, we had the ring, we had the wallet with the driver's license and with the various credit cards. So therefore, that accumulation of evidence, according to many poskim, could be relied upon, taken in its totality. So that enabled us to resolve that particular case, even though there was no other DNA identification that they were able to make on his remains or any other form of physical identification. And then with respect to another fellow who was located in the law firm that was above the point of impact, so it was known because we received the firm report. The firm cooperated with us and they did their own internal investigation, and it turned out that he was the main person who was involved in evacuating people from his firm between when the North Tower was hit and the South Tower was hit. And he said, and he was telling everybody not to stay in the building, how you had to get out. But because of the fact that there were a few people who didn't really want to leave, there were witnesses and survivors who remember seeing him rushing back to the office in order to retrieve those people to make sure that they would leave. And then shortly after he ran back to the office to make sure they would leave as well, the building was hit below the point where the office was located, and he was never heard from again. So we had strong circumstantial evidence, certainly, that he remained there at the point in which the plane was hit, and subsequently there was also DNA identification made in that case. So therefore we were able to rely upon the combination of the strong probability created through the evidence as well as the identification through DNA. Yes? There were approximately 2,700 people who we believe died in the attack. And of them, approximately, I believe, 1,500 or so were identified in one form or another, mostly, I believe, through DNA identification analysis. But there was over 1,000 people who were never identified, even by the most detailed and excruciating DNA analysis of all of the body parts that were found by the medical examiner's office. And then, just to answer your question of what about the consideration that a person simply is never heard from again, is that not relevant from a halakhic perspective? So this is discussed. There's a famous shita that was never really relied upon by itself, but always taken into consideration in the halakhic literature by Rabbi Eliezer Mivordun. Rabbi Eliezer Mivordun talks about the statement in the Gemara that a man who falls into Mayim She'ein Lehem Sof, a man who falls into the boundless body of water, we say Ishto Asura, the wife is not allowed to remarry. But if she does remarry, we don't force her to get divorced. That's what the Gemara says. So Rabbi Eliezer Mivordun goes even further, and he says, it says Ishto Asura, it says she's prohibited from getting remarried. It doesn't say Asura Liola. It doesn't say she's prohibited forever. There's a certain point in time in which if enough time has elapsed and you know there's at least the probability of death based on where the person was located, that you can combine together the probability of death with the amount of time that has elapsed to say, avad zichro, that if enough time elapsed that nobody has heard from this individual at all, that can also be a consideration in terms of permitting the wife to remarry. Because if the person was alive somewhere, you would have heard from them, or there's a strong probability. It's not a certainty. We know of cases in the Holocaust where a person was presumed dead and then they showed up 20 years later, even after sometimes a wife had remarried. So it's not a certainty that if you haven't heard from somebody that they have perished, but it also creates a separate standalone probability as well. There was a case of a street vendor who worked outside the World Trade Center, who vanished after the World Trade Center attack, and the family assumed, it was a single person, but the family assumed that the individual had perished, and then 8 months later, he showed up in one of the local hospitals. It turned out he had been very disoriented by the attacks, and couldn't really place himself, or needed a lot of psychological treatment as well as medical treatment. And as a result, there was no communication with the family, and the family actually discovered him 8 months later. There were newspaper articles about this. So this is all part of what the halacha is sensitive about. These things really, really happen. However, based on this consideration, Rabbi Eliezer Mivordun, there's a lot of discussion about it. The Gemara itself, which is in the sheets, talks about what if someone is a movie star. The Gemara doesn't say a movie star. The Gemara says a famous Talmud Chacham. That's the Gemara's equivalent of a movie star. The Gemara says, what if you have a famous Talmud Chacham who falls into a boundless body of water, but nobody hears from them for a long time? Shouldn't you be able to use that as sort of a separate probability and combine probabilities? I have not just one probability, I have two probabilities. One, that the person fell into water and didn't emerge. And two, the fact that the person would have been heard from because he's such a famous celebrity. So wherever he would have turned up, people would have said that the person was located elsewhere. And the Gemara says, no, you can't make that determination, because then you're distinguishing between people based on their celebrity status. Not everybody is a Talmud Chacham. We have to have rules that apply uniformly across the board. So later authorities, like the Trumas Hadeshin, say nowadays, where we have much better forms of communication, and you would hear from almost anybody who disappeared if they were still alive, it could be that we no longer have the problem that we would be creating all these distinctions. Maybe this is a consideration that now is applicable to everybody. If you didn't hear from them, that there's a probability that they died, and therefore nowadays, maybe we should be able to use that probability together with the other probability of death, that they fell into a body of water or whatever else happened to them that established a probability of death, in order to make a determination of death. And the Psalm Sofer talks about it in his days. It's even more pronounced. Psalm Sofer, writing in the 1800s, talks about nowadays we have telegraphs, and we have, you know, the postal service, and we have such a sophisticated form. This is before there was email, before there were cell phones, and before we had faxes, and before we have instant communication all over the world, where he says that maybe this should be revisited, and maybe the fact that a person is not heard from again is also something that could be taken into consideration. Yes? In 9/11, we don't know, meaning that I don't think that there was a statistical analysis of the number of people from every single ethnicity and every single religion. We certainly know that many Jews died. We dealt with 10 Aguna cases. We know Abati Dina dealt with approximately a total of 4 or 5 other Aguna cases. And we also were informed and were involved in other cases where there were single men or single women who died. And there were other issues, such as when to start mourning, how to bury the remains that are found when you're expecting that there might even be more remains. Do you put it in shallow earth? How do you go about the burial process? What type of a box? Do you do shrouds? So all in all, we knew of about 20 cases. I would assume that there were more, but there certainly were people from every single race, every single ethnicity, every single religion who were affected by this tragedy. It was one that did not establish any boundaries. It crossed the entire spectrum of the population.
See, I would assume statistically at least 10%. I think that's a reasonable. And what gets me, I mean, here we are, we're from people, we're careful. Social comment, maybe out of 300 people, maybe altogether 30 are so involved in the Avodas Hashem in this context.
Well, again, remember that we're dealing with a very specific situation of a woman who has lost her husband, where it's
Ariel,
a,
not just
a, right, right, but the, again, I'm talking about the issues that we came across. There could be others who came across other issues, but these are the situations in which we came across. I will say that the people who turned to us certainly spread across the entire gamut of the population, meaning it wasn't only Orthodox individuals, but even people from non-Orthodox communities who turned to the Beit Din of America as well, because the Beit Din was and is known as a rabbinical court which services the entire population, does gittin for the entire population, does dinei Torah for the entire population. And when the Aguna cases came to the fore, we had a meeting at the JCRC, Jewish Community Relations Council, in which people from across different denominations were present. I made the statement at the time that the Beit Din of America would be prepared to deal with any cases of any Jewish individual who was affected by the tragedy, regardless of whatever denomination they belonged to. That wasn't significant to us. And in fact, what followed after that meeting was that people from all over came to the Beit Din of America. And in that sense, it was a unifying event in that everybody felt comfortable working together through the same Beit Din, through the same process. And, you know, maybe that's something, you know, that we can take out of the event on the positive side, that it's possible for us to all come together as a much larger and broader Jewish community. But in any event, with respect to the third person, the third case of an individual who was in the South Tower above the point of impact, so it was known because there were people who saw him and conversed with him who escaped from the building between 8:46 a.m. when the North Tower was hit and 9:02 a.m. when the South Tower was hit. And he actually said something along the lines of, "I'm out of here," because he intended to leave. And then he was seen standing near the express elevator Beta Bank on the 78th floor by somebody who got into the elevator. And this was the last elevator that went down before the plane crashed into the building at exactly the 78th floor. So the elevators at that point were certainly disabled. And this woman testified to us, basically, that she saw him standing outside of the elevator bank and he was talking to a Port Authority officer. And the Port Authority officer was saying to him, because she overheard the conversation, and this is not to fault anybody, because nobody knew exactly what to do during that turbulent moment in time, but he was recommending the Port Authority officer that this individual stay in the building, because he felt it was safer to stay in the building than to go outside. So she actually witnessed this conversation. And then, of course, the man was never heard from again, and there were never any remains that were found from this person. So the question was, could we rely upon what essentially were perhaps two probabilities? One, he was in a location on the 78th floor where most people died when the plane hit the 78th floor of that area of the South Building. And two, had he survived, he would have had to be one of the people who went down the stairwell. And the people who went down the stairwell were generally sent to the local hospitals, and there was no record of him having been in any of the local hospitals. So there was certainly a basis to rely upon that combination of probabilities, but we also followed a time-honored tradition when resolving Aguna cases, that the Aguna cases are not only decided by the first Beis Din, but the first Beis Din gets a consensus of other rabbinic authorities throughout the world because of the weighty nature of this type of a determination and how it could affect future generations. Rabbi Willie corresponded with Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, a member of the Beis Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim, and Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg said he wasn't 100% comfortable, even though our Beis Din was comfortable, he wasn't 100% comfortable, and he wanted to be able to find yet another rabbinic authority that would agree with our analysis, and then he would present his agreement as well. So after a couple of years passed, decided this is really getting to be too much. We started to despair from the possibility of a DNA identification, because after 2 years, most of the DNA identifications had already been made. So I turned to Rav Nutter Greenblatt, who's a well-regarded posek who's been in Memphis, Tennessee for the last 60 years plus. And Rav Nutter Greenblatt felt that not only could you look at those two probabilities, but he felt that you could also, in this particular case, rely upon the analysis of the Truma Sedesha and the Chasam Sofer that given that in modern day technology, communications are so great that pretty much anybody would be able to communicate if they were still alive, or even if they were out of it, somehow other people would find them and be able to communicate that these people were still alive, and we did not hear from them and or find any trace of them being in any part of the universe. Therefore, he felt that certainly with the passage of a couple of years, which had already passed, that that could be taken into consideration as well. And therefore, he gave, in that case, which was the longest case that took the Beis Din of America to resolve, once he gave his approbation in that particular case, we had the requisite collection of authorities that we needed in order to be able to issue a letter to the widow permitting her to remarry, even though, of course, we already internally had come to the conclusion that there was certainly a basis, according to halakha, to permit her to remarry. Yes? Yes. So one, there were two remaining aguna cases besides the case that I mentioned of the husband whose wife was identified in the location of also the New York State Department of Taxation, where we knew based on where she was there was a probability of death, and that was good enough at least to permit a man to remarry. But there was a case of a Port Authority officer who was Jewish. A Jewish Port Authority officer who was working that day basically in the evacuation on the first floor of the South Tower. And then when the South Tower collapsed, basically he was presumed to be one of the victims of the debris and the entire building, beams and all, toppling on top of him. You could just imagine the horrific nature of that scene. In this particular case, they actually were able to make a significant identification of a remaining part of the body of the person in question, and based on the identification of the body, it was a sufficient simen muvhak to enable the man to remarry. The combination of the total criteria, which was both in this case a DNA identification as well as a fingerprint identification that they were able to make, because there actually had been a remnant of the fingers of this man as well in the toppling of the entire building. But yes, that was one of the cases. And the last remaining case was a man who was on one of the airplanes. He was on the American Airlines Flight 11. That was the airplane that crashed into the North Tower. In this particular case, this also was akin to essentially the Kipshana Aisha analysis, where if you knew a person was on the plane, there was no chance of survival, because once the plane hit the building, the plane just erupted into flames. So that really was a classic Kipshana Aish fiery furnaces situation, because you had all the gasoline of the plane, all the fuel that just erupted. Therefore, our analysis there required simply a communication with the American Airlines personnel and administration, confirming the fact that he was on the flight, that the boarding pass had been issued to him, that the fact that they didn't have a return of the boarding pass meant that he would be, not only got on the plane, but he stayed on the plane. We got the letters and the confirmations that we needed from American Airlines. And based on that confirmation, he was also placed into what was essentially a Kipshana Aish situation, and we were able to identify him as being one of the victims on that basis. What was additionally tragic about this entire affair is that we were dealing in many of these cases with individuals that were just beginning their flowering in life. Many of these marriages were early new marriages of newlywed couples who were just starting their lives together. And in four of the cases that I have described, the couples had their only child. The wife gave birth to the couple's only child, either immediately prior to 9/11 or in the months following 9/11. And in two of the cases, there were men who did not have any children altogether, and the wives needed to do chalitza, as I mentioned earlier in my introductory remarks, with the brother-in-law in order to be able to move on with their lives. Yes?
In the case where you said the husband lost the wife, shouldn't it, and you said that took 2 years, shouldn't it not have been an easier one to resolve? Because The wife died, right?
No, the case that took 2 years was a case where it was the husband who died. Uh-huh. It was a case of a husband who died, he worked in the same office as the case of the wife who died, but there were three people who worked in that office who had cases that were presented to us. That was the New York State Department of Taxation office, which was located on the 86th and 87th floors, I believe, of the South Tower.
Didn't you mention one case where the wife died and the husband was left?
Yes. That was also a case where the wife worked on the 86th floor. That was an easy case because we were able to establish that she was there based on telephone conversations that occurred, placing her there and placing her in a situation of probability of death. The Gesher HaChaim writes that as long as you have a probability of death with respect to a missing wife, that's sufficient to enable a husband to remarry because you don't have the same biblical implications with respect to Aishas Ish. But what I realized that when we went through this entire process and we dealt with the families and we provided this halakhic framework and we were able to systematically go through these cases and be able to resolve the cases for the benefit of the families and provide for the official halakhic statement, which was meaningful, not so much even on a factual level because everybody kind of knew what the facts were, but meaningful on a halakhic level, and it took on a spiritual sort of significance that I had more of a glimpse of understanding of the reaction of Aaron HaKohen. And I'll conclude with this. When Aaron HaKohen was faced with the terrible tragedy of the loss of two of his sons upon the event of the dedication of the Mishkan. And we're told, what was Aaron's reaction? This is classic, it's famous, it's known. In a time of unspeakable and unfathomable tragedy, what was the classic reaction that Aaron taught to us for all generations? It was Vayidom Aaron, right? He was silent. There's no philosophical explanation that you can provide to this type of tragedy, so you don't try to explain it philosophically. That would be presumptuous. Rather, he didn't have anything to say, so he was silent. But then, if you look carefully at the parsha in which this incident is described, you discover he wasn't, in fact, entirely silent. There was a conversation between Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron shortly afterwards when Moshe told him that he had to partake of the korbanos, of the sacrifices that were offered that day. And Aaron said, surely you can't mean all the sacrifices. If I'm going to eat a chatas today, is that going to be pleasing in the eyes of Hashem? And Moshe heard him and he agreed with him. And we see that Aaron was engaged in this discussion. So what kind of silence is this? And I realized that there's more to it than just the silence. Silence in terms of the philosophical exploration, because it's not our place always to provide for the answers as to why these things happen. But active participation in life in terms of framing what is the appropriate halakhic response. What are we supposed to do? Now tragedy occurred, but is there something, some prescription, some direction that the Torah gives us as to what we're supposed to do? So that's what Aaron involved himself with. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to eat? What am I supposed to not eat? How am I supposed to go about navigating my life after this tragedy has occurred? And it occurred to me, that is what the halakha provided. That is what the entire Beis Din process provided for these families, was some sort of framework, some sort of context of just asking the question, what do we do now? How do we proceed? What is the context? What's the halakhic process for proceeding? And this enabled us to provide that process, to provide that framework, and to provide somehow some sense of meaning so we can all go on in the future and so these families would be able to rebuild their lives while at the same time honoring the memory of those who had perished. Nishmasam Tzruah B'Tzruah HaChayim. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Reis. Okay. Rabbi Reis will be available for next couple minutes for questions up at the front. The Beis Din will be selling the new book that just came out downstairs by the exit. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Please join us again next week. Okay.
What? Hold on. Yeah, shut it off.